creating superheroes for everybody.
What I'm hoping for in my career is that when I leave the industry, that it will be a better industry than I found it. And, you know, we use words like diversity and inclusion, but ultimately the goal is egalitarianism, right? The goal is that everyone has equal opportunity and that everyone gets a shot to tell stories and tell stories that reflect their experiences, and by doing so, create heroes for everybody.
That's DC Comics and Warner Brothers comic book editor Joseph Illich. We talk with him about his career in comic books, bringing diversity to the superhero genre. That's on the menu today for Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. Our tagline for Writer's Voice is in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. But truth be told, there are some genres the show is pretty light on. Romance novels, for example. Another one that we seldom cover, although more than romance, is comic books. Over the years, we've talked with Art Spiegelman, Ted Rall, and others writing graphic books on political or historical themes, but not the superhero region of the genre. Well, today we right that wrong. We have an amazing conversation with one of the most innovative and important figures in the field of superhero comics, Joseph Illich. He was the first Black editor of the Batman series, and throughout his career, now more than 20 years, he's worked to bring diverse voices of many kinds to superhero comics, including gay superheroes, disabled superheroes, women, and people of color. Joseph Illich is a comic book writer and editor who's been working with DC Comics and Warner Brothers for much of his career. He's a public speaker on the subjects of race, comics, and the corporate politics of diversity. He helped to launch Catalyst Prime, the multicultural superhero comic book imprint. Well, Joseph Illich, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So you are a comic book writer and editor. You don't do the drawings, is that right?
That's correct. So as an editor, one of the things that I do is I bring together the talent to work on the book. So in that capacity, I have the opportunity to choose artists for different comic book and graphic novel projects, but I do not do the art.
Say a little bit about how you got into the field and what drew you to being in the comic book field.
Well, I grew up on comics ever since I was a kid, going back to the second grade. And I did originally want to be a comic book artist. I went to High School of Art and Design and School of Visual Arts, both of which are in Manhattan. And the truth of it is that I really didn't have the skill to draw from the imagination like comic book artists do. I had the skill to draw from observation. And so those are two totally different set of skills. And I had a really sobering conversation with a friend of mine when I got out of college that made me understand that I did not have the artistic capability to draw the comic books that I loved. But something that happened to me in college is that I talked with more of my friends and they felt that I had a good grasp of story and said, you know, you should think of being a writer. And so that was a shift that I made in my early 20s out of college. And my start in the industry was through an internship at a company called Milestone Media Inc., which was the first Black-owned comic book publisher to have a distribution deal with Giant of a company, which in this case was DC Comics. And I started as an intern there. At first, I wasn't interested because we're talking about 1993. So you're talking about a free internship in which they offered enough money for lunch and a small stipend for transportation. And this was before, for the New Yorkers who are listening, this was before MetroCards allowed you to do free transfers. So I lived in a two fare zone and I had to pay each fare. And I was actually only getting a stipend for one fare. So I was actually losing money every day that I was interning at Milestone. But the experience and knowledge that I gained from it was so vast that I was willing to do it. And I was there for 3 months. And then I spoke to the president of the company one day and I really expressed my gratitude for everything that everyone had done for me and what I had learned. But I said I had to really get back out there and hit the pavement for a job. And I went to lunch. And when I came back, they offered me a part-time position as his assistant. And so I started as the assistant to the president, part-time, and I learned about the business aspects of a comic book company. You know, its financial infrastructure, the people that you need to actually have a comic book company. And after being promoted to full-time assistant to the president and spending, I think, a year in that role, I transitioned over to editorial and learned what being an editor was. And I didn't know. It was something that when I was growing up, it was a name that I saw in all the comic books, but I didn't care about it. It wasn't sexy. It wasn't a role that anyone spoke about. So that was my introduction to what being an editor was. And that was when I realized that that was a career path for me. And with Milestone, seeing a Black-owned company with this superhero universe that was truly diverse, not only in the ethnic backgrounds of the characters and the creators and the staff, but this company introduced some of the first queer characters, some of the first characters with disabilities into the superhero genre. And so Milestone was really ahead of its time. And that was how my career began in the industry.
Talk a little bit about the industry as a whole. I mean, it was my impression of the comic book field is that it's dominated by a pretty macho culture and certainly has been overwhelmingly white until, as you say, until Milestone came along.
Right. So one of the things about the comic book industry is a lot of people like to think that because comic books are fun, that the comic book industry is different from any other industry that was born in the United States. And that's just not the case. It reflects the same social dynamics, gender dynamics, racial dynamics. And so at the time when Milestone started publishing books, which was 1993, yes, the industry was dominated by white males. There were barely any women in the industry at the time. The most notable one was Jeanette Kahn, who was the president of DC Comics. But she was an outlier. I mean, she was a force. Jeanette Kahn was a force of nature. And that allowed her to have a position like that, that a lot of the other companies did not have. And so Milestone was really a pebble in the pond, and the ripple effects of Milestone have extended into the present. And so that was the beginning of a paradigm shift for the entire comic book industry. And now the comic book industry has a greater female readership than it does a male readership. When you take into consideration that the comic book industry is not just the comic books that are sold in floppies, magazine, monthly form, and the comic book stores throughout the United States and the European Union, comic books and graphic novels are now part of the larger trade book industry. So highly regarded book publishers like Penguin Random House and Macmillan have graphic novel divisions, and there women are the dominant presence, the dominant editorial, business, authoritative presence. So right now, there's more women in the comic book and graphic novel industry than there have ever been. There's more people of color than there have ever been. And the fight still continues for equal presence and equal representation in the stories. That said, the more people that you have working on the stories, the more decision makers that you have that represent people outside of the white male heterosexual model, the more variety that you will have in the stories that are coming to the industry, through the industry to the public.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with comic book editor Joseph Illich. He's one of the leading figures in the superhero space, bringing diversity to the comic book genre. In addition to his other work, he's executive editor for Heavy Metal, an illustrated magazine for science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And you've been and continue to be such an important part of that. Talk about Catalyst Prime. This is a multicultural superhero comic book imprint.
Right. So Catalyst Prime really was created by David Stewart II and Carl Reed. So those two gentlemen are the owners of Lion Forge. Lion Forge is a multimedia company. Right now, they're actually primarily an animation company. There was an animated short called Hair Love about a black father and his daughter and taking care of her hair that won prestigious awards and is now going to be the basis for, I think, an HBO Max animated series. So before really getting into animation, Lion Forge was into comic book and graphic novel publishing, and they wanted to make a superhero universe. They were very inspired by the character of Static, who was created and originated at Milestone and would go on to be the star of a well-known and beloved animated cartoon called Static Shock. So they were very inspired by Static, and they wanted their own superhero universe. And I knew them from when Lion Forge launched, I think it was in 2013. And they came to me and said, we'd like you to be the senior editor, and we'd like you to editorially shepherd this line and bring it into creation. So bring together the creative teams, set up the books, and launch this line. And we announced it at New York Comic Con of 2016. And it was one of the biggest stories of that convention. And the line launched in 2017, was really well received by the public, by the industry, and the diversity of the characters allowed us to get into different types of stories and really highlight people from different communities. So in addition to having people of color, we had a good representation of women. We had characters with disabilities. One of the books was called Summit, which was about a woman named Valentina Resnick-Baker, who is a Jewish queer astrophysicist who suffered from PTSD. And the story was about how Val had to go from being someone who wanted to be left alone and didn't want to deal with the world because she suffered a tragedy, from someone who realized that her purpose in the world was to use her vast knowledge of science to protect the world from those who would use science to exploit people and exploit the planet. And we had another title called Superb. Superb was about a teenage boy with Down syndrome and a black girl, and they were best friends and they were a superhero duo. And in editing that book, I worked closely with the National Down Syndrome Society. So they worked with myself, my assistant editor, and the writers and the artists, so we could make sure that the representation of people with Down syndrome was accurate and authentic. And it was really an amazing time. It was really a well-received line of books. And those characters are living on. The books don't come out with the same monthly frequency, so the publisher has different plans for the characters. But it was a really great launch, and it was really an honor to do it, because from my point of view, it was the 21st century milestone, in a sense. So having come from Milestone and paid that forward to the comic book industry and the fans and the world by helping to shepherd a new universe of diverse heroes was really an honor.
And now, talking about superheroes, now you were the first Black editor, is that right, at DC Comics?
I was not the first Black editor, period, but I was the first Black editor to work on Batman. So the first Black editor, I believe, was named James Owsley, now known as Christopher Priest, a well-known writer of characters like the Black Panther. And I was the first Black editor ever to be a part of the Batman editorial department. And that was from 1998 to 2000. After I left Milestone, I did a very short stint at Simon & Schuster in their Star Trek novel and book division, which was an interesting experience. And then before Simon & Schuster, I temped DC Comics. So when a vacancy appeared in the Batman editorial department, they offered me the position and I took it. I was reluctant because Simon & Schuster gave me a job when I needed it, but one of the high-ranking people who I answered to said, you'd be crazy if you don't run over there and take that job. So I did. And that was very kind of her to say, a woman named Margaret Clark. So I was there for 3 years. And during that time, you know, I really continued the mission of bringing diverse talent to different characters and different worlds, and also the idea of representation expanded, because one of the books that I edited in the Batman editorial department was called Birds of Prey, which would end up becoming the basis for a live action film that came out 2 years ago that starred Margot Robbie. And was really about a duo of female action heroes. So it was this big worldwide spy adventure story. And one of the two main characters was a wheelchair user. So now I had to expand my thinking and understand that as an editor of Birds of Prey, I had to make sure that wheelchair users were represented properly, which was a little bit of an education for me and a big responsibility that I took seriously. I remember one time I had some pages, and the character whose name is Barbara Gordon, who's the daughter of James Gordon, the commissioner from the Batman movies. So her code name was Oracle, and she was the wheelchair user. And I had a page where she was wearing platform shoes. And one of my colleagues, a man, came to me and said, you know, that page looks nice, but that's not realistic, because why would she wear platform shoes? And in my mind, I was thinking, wow, you know nothing about women. But I was like, don't worry about it. You know, you handle your titles, I'll handle mine. It'll all work out. And that was an example not only of someone not understanding women, but not understanding that just because you're a wheelchair user doesn't mean you don't have a sense of fashion, right? It doesn't mean that you're only going to wear flats because it's not like you can walk. You know what I'm saying? So these are the things that, as an editor, in addition to bringing together the creators to do the stories, in addition to making sure that everyone works on a timely schedule, in addition to being a caretaker of these characters that a company entrusts you to safeguard, you have to look out for how these characters represent real world people and lifestyles.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with comic book editor Joseph Illich. He's one of the leading figures in the superhero space, bringing diversity to the comic book genre. And, you know, so interesting what you say, because I read a piece that you wrote for CBR.com, The Black Masculinity Triangle of Virgil, Luke Cage, and Cyborg, in which you, yes. you make the point, well, tell us about Virgil and you know, just there, you make the point that this is a character, a black character that has to fight against prejudice in his own community. So I'd like you to ask you to talk about that. And then also, you know, it sounds to me as if you have been educated about prejudice towards others because of the position that you have. You've been able to generalize that, enlarge that view. So there's a lot to unpack there, but give it sure. a go.
All right, I'll take a shot at it. So Virgil is a graphic novel that was created and written by Steve Orlando, had a really amazing art team, and it was about a Jamaican cop who was gay and who was trying to keep his sexual orientation a secret. Because in the Caribbean, homosexuality is frowned upon, seriously frowned upon. And I remember the writer suggesting that I watch this documentary on Vice that spoke about how the queer community in Jamaica, a number of them lived on the streets. They were kicked out of their homes by their families. They lived in fear of their lives. So they lived in like these underground, seemingly underground communities, in tunnels and in shacks for fear of their lives. And my mother is Jamaican. She was born and raised in Jamaica as a young girl. So I'm Jamaican American. I was well aware of the anti-queer stance from Jamaica, but I had no idea that it was life-threatening and that that was not unique. And so Virgil's conflict was very much a regional experience, right? And there's different ways in which communities view homosexuality. Black communities view it in very specific ways. So if Virgil was white, it wouldn't be the same. Virgil being black, Jamaican, and queer, then also being a cop, the kind of role that seemingly makes it necessary for you to be hyper-masculine, really presented serious conflicts for him. And when his secret is found out, how his life unravels as a result. And so part of what the article was about is that Black masculinity is not a single idea. It's very much multi-layered, multi-experience, and how these characters, Virgil and Luke Cage, now known from the Marvel Netflix series, and Cyborg, known from the Justice League film, and younger people will know him from the Teen Titans animated shows, how these three characters represented different views on Black masculinity, and how that was only the tip of the iceberg, and how that translates to learning about prejudice in the comic book industry in general is because, you know, Walter Mosley wrote a book called Life Out of Context. And one of the things he poses in that book is that a lot of people are unafraid, or more accurately, they're very afraid to take on a cause because a cause is so big, it's so abstract, and you're just one person. But if you pick a micro cause, if you pick a single thing and you pursue it doggedly, you will learn that other people are actually heading in the same direction that you are. And eventually what you'll be talking about is a movement, and you won't be alone. So operating in the comic book industry and being an advocate for diversity put me next to people from other communities, and I was able to learn to some degree how queer people were discriminated against, how disabled people were discriminated against, how queer people in all their different varieties, how people are more accepting of some versions than others, right? So, okay, if you are a lesbian or if you are a homosexual male, some people will say, okay, that I get. You're bisexual? Oh, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in bisexuality, right? So then within a certain supposed progressive mindedness, there's still a bias, right? So again, the comic book industry in that way is very much a reflection of America and the larger world in general, in that people have to be supported and fought for as an ally as much as the characters and the representations of the ideas. You know, the comic book industry is one that involves a lot of online harassment through social media. And so that is something that we contend with on a regular basis.
Yes, I've seen that you've written about, well, actually somebody asked you a question about what is like a top priority for the industry. And you pointed out this online harassment. You know, I'm going to go back to what we were talking about, but just take a little detour here to say more about the harassment and how that's linked to, you know, the kinds of the goals and the priorities that you have.
Right. So what I'm hoping for in my career is that when I leave the industry, that it will be a better industry than I found it. And, you know, we use words like diversity and inclusion, but ultimately the goal is egalitarianism, right? The goal is that everyone has equal opportunity and that everyone gets a shot to tell stories and tell stories that reflect their experiences. And by doing so, create heroes for everybody. Everybody should be able to fight a hero. Online harassment is the magnification of the voice of the vocal minority that cannot deal with the fact that the world is changing. They cannot deal with the fact that the white male heterosexual supremacy is coming to an end. And so they can't hit the world because the world's too big. They can't hit the corporations because the corporations are too big, but they can hit a person. They can hit an actress like Kelly Marie Tran from the Star Wars films. They can hit a Black writer. They can hit a queer artist. They can inflict pain on those people and get satisfaction from it and make themselves feel like they're still powerful. So the war against online harassment, and to call it war almost gives that vocal minority too much credit, but it is significant. And so the war against that is part of the same fight, is part of the same fight for equality in the comic book industry, for a level of diversity and inclusion behind the scenes and in the characters and in the creative pool, hopefully to reach the point where we won't even have to use those words anymore because their existence will be automatic.
Joseph Illich, stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Now let's get back to our conversation with Joseph Illich, editorial director and writer in the comics genre. So let's go back to this article, The Black Masculinity Triangle. You've talked about Virgil. Then there's Luke Cage. And I was very interested because Luke Cage was started in the 1970s by Marvel Comics. And he was a black superhero who represented, as you write, the kind of mythical superhuman power attributed to black men by bigots throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, and even, of course, many bigots today. And then talk about Black Panther and Wakanda. I mean, to me, when I first heard about the Black Panther movie, I was almost confused because I remember very well the Black Panther, you know, the Black Panther Party. And I was so interested that now, you know, Black Panthers went from being, you know, seen by the dominant white society as something evil and bad to superheroes. So there's a kind of evolution here between Luke Cage and Black Panther. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Right. So Black Panther was introduced in the 60s in the Fantastic Four series created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And yes, the Black Panther character was introduced when the Black Panther Party was early in its inception. And the way the story goes, the Black Panther superhero character was originally called the Black Leopard, but that people at Marvel saw the Black Panther Party and thought Black Panther would be a cooler name. So while there's technically no connection between the Black Panther Party and the Black Panther character, there is a connection through the name, and they actually do represent in part the same thing, which is liberation from colonialism. Right. So just as the Black Panther Party was about the liberation of the individual, primarily black individuals, but not exclusively black individuals, from the colonialist capitalism of the American government and similar governmental systems, the fictional nation of Wakanda in the Marvel Comics, which is where the Black Panther was born and resides, represents a vast, intellectually superior, technologically superior, more socialist society of African people who were never enslaved, never invaded successfully by Europeans. And so Wakanda became this separate society from the world. And part of what the Black Panther movie discussed is that deciding to separate yourself from the world does not absolve you from the responsibility of sharing your gifts to make a better world. And so the film was about civic responsibility.
So the film is 2018
was when the film came out.
So it's 2018, but you're saying that it is derived from an actual Marvel comic character from the 1960s.
Yes.
Wow, that I didn't know. So at the same time, so in the 1960s, they have this, you know, superhero, progressive superhero, I guess you could say. And then in the 1970s, they have Luke Cage, who it seems like they've lost a bit of their wokeness in the meantime.
Well, what happened was Luke Cage was two white men making their best effort to create a Black superhero, but believing that Blaxploitation was literal. So they used Blaxploitation as a reference for what they thought definitive Black culture was. Blaxploitation was, in fact, a film genre that had magnified qualities of culture, the same way any genre has magnified qualities of our lives, whether it's romance, horror, science fiction. And so Luke Cage was a reflection of Blaxploitation, so that made him two parts removed from real Black life. And he was a person who was framed for a crime he didn't commit. He was a prisoner. I believe he had a life sentence. And so to get out of that life sentence, he allowed himself to be subjected to a dangerous experiment. And in the aftermath of that, he survived and had bulletproof skin. And there's really a lot to unpack in that. When you talk about Black men imprisoned for crimes they didn't commit and given lifetime sentences, when you talk about the scientific community experimenting on Black men with dangerous conditions, of course, that tracks back to the infamous Tuskegee experiment. When you talk about a Black man who is empowered with bulletproof skin, you know, you have a lot of these superheroes. They have vast abilities. You know, this person did not have Superman level power. He did not have Batman's wealth. He did not have Iron Man's technology. He had bulletproof skin. But the thing about bulletproof skin during the 70s when you're Black is it is the most relevant superpower a Black superhero could have, because the 60s were full of leaders getting killed by bullets ripping through their bodies in operations that were engineered by the United States government. So when you talk about being Black and you see and you understand Martin Luther King Jr. being assassinated, Malcolm X being assassinated, wouldn't the fantasy for a Black person in the 70s be to be bulletproof?
Exactly. Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with comic book editor Joseph Illich about his work, especially his work in bringing diversity into comics. So let's talk a little bit about your writing. First of all, you have a guide that you're out with, the Access Guide, which is a guide to this whole universe of, of comic books and fantasy. But I'm interested in some of your own writing, which you've done with other people. For example, MPLS Sound. This sounds like a wonderful graphic novel. You did the writing along with Hannibal Taboo. The illustrator was Meredith Laxton. It kind of encapsulates a lot of what you're talking about in terms of giving a space to, you know, really diverse voices in you know, to promote that egalitarianism that, you know, we must have if we're going to survive as a society.
Yeah, definitely. You know, with MPLS Sound, it was really interesting to dive into that time period. MPLS Sound stands for Minneapolis Sound, which is the musical movement that came out of Minneapolis in the 80s. The most well-known icon and forerunner of that movement was Prince, God rest his soul. And so the graphic novel is the story of a fictional band called Starchild that was led by a Black woman named Teresa Booker. And Starchild competed against a number of Minneapolis bands with the goal of becoming Prince's band. So in the alternate timeline that this takes place in, there would have been no Prince and the Revolution. It would have been Prince and Starchild. Now, why that didn't happen, what the rise and fall of Starchild was, how they exist between the raindrops of our real history, that's what the story of MPLS Sound is. And at the center of it is a Black woman who saw Jimi Hendrix play the guitar on the Dick Cavett Show when she was a little girl, and her life was changed forever. She saw that and wanted to be able to do that. And her father was a short-lived failed musician, and he would not allow her to delude herself by playing a guitar. So when she wanted to play the guitar as a young girl, he told her no, because he said there was no future in Minneapolis for a Black woman who wanted to be a guitar player in a band. So that was the beginning of Teresa's journey to fight the world and to do what she wanted to do. And she ended up becoming an amazing guitarist. And when she saw Prince perform live, that really activated or it further catalyzed that desire in her. And she decided to start a band. And she brought together a diverse band. And the reason she did that was because the 80s Minneapolis scene was dominated by rock, and it was dominated by white male rock. There was a company called Twin Tone that was basically responsible for producing and controlling those acts. And so Teresa knew that to fight the system, she had to in part represent the system. So she created Starchild out of people from different backgrounds, some of whom were white. And she wanted to create a band that had funk and soul and rock all mixed in the same way that Prince did with his music. Prince was definitely aware of the work of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Parliament. And so Starchild competed against all these different bands, and in doing so, get closer and closer to the goal. And what happens on the way is what the book is about. And working with Hannibal, who is a well-known music historian, working with Meredith, who's the artist, and being able to see how she helped bring Teresa and the characters of the band Starchild to life was definitely inspiring. And it's part of the beauty of comic books in that it's a collaborative medium with the smallest number of creators. But because of that, there's something more intimate about creating a comic book or a graphic novel than there is than creating a television show or creating a film. And so being able to tell that story in one book, as a graphic novel as opposed to over four or five comic books was really great, because then you do get an entire story. You do get an entire journey in one book. And so MPLS Sound came out in April. The publisher is named Humanoids, and it's distributed in bookstores through Simon & Schuster, one of the top five publishers. And so, yeah, it was really a labor of love for us and part of the personal story of being able to plant your flag in the world through your art, having to fight against a system that you know that not only do you have the human right to be a part of, but a system that co-opted a number of things that your people brought into culture and thus brought into industry. So, you know, for her, it started with Jimi Hendrix and then continued on to Prince and then would continue on with her and her band. And Prince actually makes a number of appearances in the graphic novel, as do a number of well-known musicians and producers in Prince's orbit. So, you know, if you're going to tell a historical fiction story, you've got to interweave real people. But the fun is doing it in a way in which it's organic to the story instead of just simply being an Easter egg.
An Easter egg?
So an Easter egg is kind of in pop culture what's known as something that's in a story as a clue to something bigger. So certain characters can be in the story and it's like, oh, I know where this fits now in history. Or, oh, okay, that's pretty cool that you put that character in there. That's pretty cool that you made that reference. So the people that we put in there had to serve a purpose for the story and for Teresa's personal journey. And I think we accomplished that.
It sounds great.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's basically like the Purple Rain of graphic novels.
That's great.
Yeah.
You've got another project. You have another project coming, Solar Man, or maybe you've already done this project. It was hard to tell. This was a character originally created by Marvel Comics in 1989, written by the great Stan Lee. And he was white then. You've made the character black. Tell us about Solar Man.
Right. So that character started out being published by Marvel as part of their superhero universe. The owners of Solar Man, David Oliphant and Deborah Coleman, a married couple, they came to a publisher named Scout Comics and Scout Comics president Brendan Dineen and wanted to update Solar Man for the 21st century. And they felt that it was important that he be black. And so Brendan and I had known each other for years. And Brendan came to me and said, listen, I have this project. I'm not the person to write it, though, because I'm white. And so I would like to have you involved in this and co-write this with me. And I thought that was really exciting. And I got to meet the owners and they were very open to our ideas. And so it was a 3-issue miniseries, which I wrote and edited. I brought together the creative team. And it was very interesting to be able to take a character that existed before as a white character as part of the Marvel Comics superhero universe and then re-envision them as a 21st century superhero outside of a superhero universe without the trappings of that. And one of the things that we did was we set the character in East New York, Brooklyn. Because when you look at a lot of the superheroes, number one, Brooklyn is mostly ignored, right? And I believe Miles Morales, who's the Afro-Latino Spider-Man. I think he lives in Brooklyn, but he certainly doesn't live in East New York. And so East New York is probably the last area in Brooklyn to get hit by the gentrification wave. And so we thought that that was a perfect location to start this superhero story because, you know, if you're going to reflect Black life, then you have to reflect Black life in different economic and social strata. Also, he was a child from an interracial marriage. His mom was white. His father was Black. And so doing that as well, we thought was very interesting. And just being able to show how the journey of a Black teenage boy gaining powers in this world would be different than a white teenage boy gaining powers in this world. And we actually deal with run-ins with the government. We deal with run-ins with the police and use the opportunity of basically a story of someone becoming a hero to, again, show some kind of truth of experience in our world. And what, you know, the vocal minority will say is we're pandering. That's what the vocal minority always says, pandering. Meanwhile, what it really is, it's a reflection of life. And it's a reflection of lives that people don't necessarily want to look at. They don't want to acknowledge that these things exist in their world because they don't want to have any connection to it. But these are things that, as a society, as you said earlier, we're not going to evolve. We're not going to move further unless we can take a look at all of it with open eyes and take an ownership of our system's deficiencies and deal with the reckoning of comfort while other people suffer. Comfort while other people suffer on a daily basis, right? You're talking about Black lives. You're talking about queer lives. You're talking about women's bodies being regulated by the government. These things have to be looked at and discussed, and it's not pandering to do it. It is social responsibility.
Well, that's a great place to end and a very powerful one. Joseph Illich, it has been such a privilege to talk with you today on Writer's Voice. You've opened up a whole new world to us here on this program, and one that I'm going to follow up on in reading some of your work as well as the work that you've referenced. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much, Francesca. It's been great to be here and good talking with you.
Go to writersvoice.net for links to Joseph Illich's work. You can also find there the Oscar-winning short he mentioned, Hair Love. Originally, we planned to air this week our interview with recycling maven Jenny Romer about her book, Can I Recycle This? Alas, we ran out of time, so we'll post it on our website on July 8th and air it on broadcast later this summer. But here's a sneak preview. Reduce, reuse, recycle. That's the mantra of recycling. But tell us, what does it really mean? What does recycling mean? And you know, I heard once that there was a kind of pyramid with reduce, reuse, recycle. So talk about that mantra and what recycling is.
Yeah, so the reduce, reuse, recycle mantra has been around since the 70s. And really the things that we should be concentrating on the most are supposed to be in that order. So reduction, reuse, and then recycling. But there's been a whole lot of marketing about recycling. And so it's very intentional that so many of us really think of recycling as the best thing that we can do to have a positive impact or have less of an impact on the environment. the plastics industry spent a lot of money in the late 80s, early 90s on marketing plastic as recyclable, in part because they saw that there were some laws that were pending, some local laws that were pending, targeted at reducing plastic use. And so they thought, oh, if we spend a lot of time on marketing, money on marketing, and make people feel better about using plastic, it won't be regulated as much. And so that worked. And plastic packaging has not been very regulated until very recently.
Well, here. You know, it's funny. You mentioned in the book, Suffolk County, New York, which is where I live, that in 1988, it adopted a ban on plastic grocery bags and other plastic food containers, got sued. That failed, that legislation, I guess, or was undone. Recently, a couple of years ago, we passed a plastic grocery bag ban. It's going very well. In my hometown in East Hampton, we banned plastic straws, and other towns around us have followed, and it may even be on the Suffolk County level. So it takes a long time, 1988, to 19, over 40, is that 30 years that it took to finally get that to happen. Do you feel that this is a movement that is strengthening?
Plastic bags and plastics in general. So it started with plastic bags, really. Like I said, San Francisco was kind of at the forefront of that. They were the first city to pass and implement a ban or, regulation on single-use plastic carry-out bags. And now there are over 550 local jurisdictions and 9 states that have plastic bag laws in effect. I see that as kind of a gateway to other reduction of other plastics. So, once people are getting comfortable with that, we've also seen laws regulating or banning foam foodware, people call styrofoam foodware, on straws. And now we're seeing other types of utensils regulated. And then what I work on more and more now is regulations of all that other stuff that's on the grocery store shelves. So the bread bags and the hummus containers and all that other packaging.
Jenny Romer talking with us about her book, Can I Recycle This? Check out the full interview at writersvoice.net, and we'll also broadcast it later this summer. And next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with novelists Celia Jeffries and Megha Majumdar. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.